Good morning, Kansas City. Welcome to Free Market Underground, where every week we bring you all things boom and bust. My name is Chris Butler, portfolio manager with Butler Lands and Wagler, and Free Market Underground is produced every week by Mr. Martell Love, and this show is sponsored by Butler Lands and Wagler. Good morning, Mr. Martell Love.
Good morning, Chris Butler, and happy St. Patrick's Day to you.
Yeah, top of the morning.
Top of the morning to you.
Yeah, and I was going to actually break out an Irish accent there and realized that, I probably can't do one.
Is it not culturally appropriate?
You're right. It might not be. I don't know who I'm offending.
Right, true.
But they would, I tell you what, Irish people would be very offended at my attempt because it ain't very good. That's for sure. So you got big plans going to the parade?
Yeah, I plan on going to the parade here right after the show. Going to enjoy myself and have a green one.
Yeah, you know what? I think, is March 17th always the day of St. Patrick's
Every
Day?
Year.
Yeah. I think that it almost always coincides with the NCAA tournament, too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So it's hard for me to separate St. Patrick's Day from the tourney, you know? They kind of go together. They go hand in hand.
Yeah, you're right.
However, sometimes, of course, it falls on one of those days where there might not be any games. But,
true.
But sometimes it does.
Yeah,
and this will be one of them.
Well, yeah, we will have games today.
That's right.
And it also, the NCAA tournament and St. Patrick's Day, they lead right up into opening day of baseball.
Yes, they do.
Yes.
You don't have to wait long.
You don't have to wait long. The spring is in the air, Chris Butler.
Right,
I love this time of year.
I do, too. And, in fact, Friday morning when I walked into the studio and got a windy rain in the face, I thought, you know what? This is spring.
Yeah. Bring it on, Rain.
Yeah, that's right. We needed it, too.
I'll take it over the snow any day.
Oh, absolutely. And I had heard some weatherman on the radio say that the amount of rain or precipitation that we had had this year to date going into Friday was almost zero. It was just a little bit more than zero, but might as well have been zero. I think we really needed this quite a bit.
Well, I bet the farmers are happy.
Yes, they are.
Yes.
I'm sure they wanted more because what we got, I don't think was that much. Maybe there were parts of the area that got some significant rain.
Now, when we have droughts like this, how does that impact the economy?
Well, you know, it certainly impacts the agricultural economy, and it does so in terms of yield, although most farms today are going to have sophisticated irrigation devices. But,
yes.
You know, really, it's not going to have that much of a drought is not as bad as too much rain, economically
really?
Speaking. Yeah, because too much rain, then you get flooding and actual destruction of property.
Sure.
It takes a lot for a drought to have a non-farm impact. And farms, like I said, have pretty much figured out a way to use technology to get around absolute dependency on rain, which, of course, 200 years ago when this country started, was probably the biggest risk to the economy was whether or not it rained.
Mm-hmm.
Can you believe that? And
wow.
Today we don't even bat an eye.
Huh.
Don't even talk about
Look
it.
Look how far
really.
We've come.
We have come a long way, baby. No doubt, in fact, you know, I might maybe next week I will actually talk about that and put up a chart because it's a wonderful economics story. But if you look at how much of U.S. GDP, the percentage of U.S. GDP that was farming from like 1800 to today,
yeah,
it is amazing because it is such a tiny part of our GDP today.
Wow.
Yet we produce so much more. Right?
Yeah.
And the only way you can do that is with technology and innovation.
Yep. That's amazing to me. So
it is.
It just goes to show if the internet goes down for a day or something
right.
like that, we're screwed, basically.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And, you know, within that broader story of agriculture is also the story of the advent of organic.
Yes.
Right? And so you do actually have small family-run farms today. I don't know if it's more than 20 years ago. I would suspect perhaps that is the case. Some people are willing to pay up for organic, right? And
yeah.
So you've got farms and dairies that specialize in that. So that, too, is maybe not a nod to innovation, but a nod to consumer preferences. So you've, on the one hand, you have mass-produced agriculture, which satisfies the need for food on a broad scale. And on the other hand, you have organic farms that are catering to those that want a specific type of agriculture. So it's a good story. Agriculture in the U.S. is a good history. I don't even know if there's a book out there, I suspect there is, that covers the change in agriculture from, say, 1800 to today. But if it does exist, I'm sure it's an interesting book because it's almost entirely a story about technology and consumer preference. All right, let's take a look at the big items this week. Actually, I guess from an economics perspective, the biggest story was Larry Kudlow being named as the chairman of the national, or director, I guess they call it, of National Economic of the National Economic Council. That was a position once held by Gary Cohn. This is what I like about Larry Kudlow. Number one, he's a free market guy. I am not a supply sider, although I certainly would prefer that type of economic policy as opposed to many, if not most, economic policies. So I really do like the appointment of Larry Kudlow, but there's something else I like about the guy. Obviously, he's free market. If anybody's out there ever heard him speak on CNBC or his own radio show, yeah, he's a free market guy, sticks up for freedom in economics. That's what I like most. But also, Gary Cohn, I don't think, had a PhD in economics either, but neither does Larry Kudlow. And I think at that position, he's probably going to be working with a bunch of academics. And I think it's good that Larry Kudlow is not an academic. I hope, actually, that Larry Kudlow will bring a little bit more practical, common sense economics to that council to offset some of the more PhD academic modelers, spreadsheet users, statistical soothsayers. And I hope he brings a little bit of common sense to him. And I think he will. And I said there were two things mainly, and there are. Those are the two main things I like about the guy. He is not an academic economist, number one. Number two, he is a free market guy. But if you wanted to add a third element, and I do actually, and now that I think about it, maybe this is also as important as those two. It's the fact that Larry Kudlow is not an abrasive kind of politico, if you will. He is somebody that tries to find common ground and one of the nicest guys. I mean, this guy has as many Democrat left-leaning friends as he does right-leaning. He's just a good guy, very intellectually open-minded, will recognize a good argument and say, that is a good argument, but here is why I think the way I do. And I think at the end of the day, what Donald Trump is going to have is a coterie of people that are going to be able to articulate both sides of just about every argument, which, by the way, Donald Trump had with Gary Cohn, too. But I don't think Gary, and I know Gary Cohn was not as free market a guy as Larry. Gary Cohn was not as much of a consensus builder as Larry Kudlow is. So you get something with Larry you didn't have with Gary, even though Gary Cohn probably was more on that free market side than one might expect given his politics. So I like that. I like the nomination. I think it's great. And I'm looking forward to see in about 2, 3, 4, 5 months the emphasis that Trump is putting on Peter Navarro versus Larry Kudlow. And I don't doubt for a second that Larry Kudlow doesn't know Peter Navarro. I don't doubt that he hasn't talked to him at length. Heck, if you ask Larry, he probably likes Peter Navarro. There's almost no one Larry Kudlow does not like. So I actually kind of like the addition of Kudlow to that mix and hope that something good comes out of it, and I think it will. If you've got, you know, I heard someone criticize Donald Trump the other day by saying this is not a team of rivals kind of guy, Donald Trump. He likes yes men. You know, I don't know that that's true or not. I haven't looked into it that deeply, but the appointment of Larry Kudlow would tell me that he is maybe more team of rivals than that critic was really suggesting. He is willing to listen to the other side. If he wasn't, he wouldn't have taken Larry Kudlow. Now, at the end of the day, is he going to veto Larry Kudlow on a fairly routine basis? That's likely. But at least he's getting, I think, a better argument for the other side, so that Donald Trump, and this is what your job is if you're an advisor to the president, you just make sure that the president is armed with enough information to make an intelligent decision. And that, I think, Larry Kudlow can do. And I think he can do it very, very well. So that was kind of like the big story of the week. Markets struggled this week, so maybe that was another story, but probably not that big because they didn't struggle that much. I think the markets were down. Maybe it was the Dow that was down like 3 days in a row, 4 days in a row, but I think maybe the S&P was too. If it wasn't, it was just by a day. So markets did struggle, just maybe not that much. In fact, I think the Dow was struggling with a very weak Boeing component. And remember, the Dow Jones only has 30 stocks in it. So if one of those 30 is struggling, it's going to affect the whole index. And I think that was the case this week. Last thing I want to make mention of before we take a break, and I think I will take a break, and then when we get back, I'll talk about it. And that's the bankruptcy of Toys R Us. That also garnered some attention and some headlines. I do want to talk about that, but right now we need to take a break. You're listening to Free Market Underground, all things boom and bust on KCMO Talk Radio 710 and 103.7 FM as well. Welcome back to Free Market Underground, where every week we talk about all things boom and bust. My name is Chris Butler, portfolio manager with Butler Lands and Wagler. Just talked about Larry Kudlow being named to the National Economic Council, the head of it, this week, which I think was a good hire. Not that my opinion matters, but I think it's a good hire. Now we're going to move on to maybe the second biggest headline grabber in the world of economics and finance this week, that being Toys R Us. We've known they were going bankrupt, but I think on Wednesday night they announced they were closing all U.S. stores. I believe they announced the day before closing all foreign stores. A couple of interesting things, I think, about the Toys R Us story. And the first one is that people want to say that this is due to the Amazon effect gutting out brick-and-mortar retail, and certainly that is a part of it. And in fact, it was probably the end game for Toys R Us was the fact that they couldn't compete with Amazon.com. But it's not the first 80 to 90% of the story. The first 80 to 90% of the story is that in 2005 or around there, they were a publicly traded company or bought private by a public equity company that then saddled them with a bunch of debt. That debt was increasingly burdensome to this company. They couldn't get out from underneath that debt and were struggling with $400 million worth of interest payments every year on that debt. Now, something happens to a store when you get that, or any firm, when you get that kind of debt burden that you just can't hardly handle. First thing is you cannot pay quality employees. So the business suffers from a brain drain. Secondly, at the actual point of contact with customers, you can't afford to get great people there either. In fact, you can't afford to have enough of them. And when you don't have enough people meeting and greeting customers, it turns customers off. And it spirals out from there. You also, by the way, don't have enough money to put into your retail operation to make routine upgrades to the way the store looks. Generally speaking, a lot of those struggling companies' retail presence, it's dirty. not well kept because you don't have enough employees, and the ones you do, you're not paying enough. And the whole thing gets worse exponentially. That's what I think happened for the first, from 2005 on, for sure, when they got saddled with that debt. And then, yes, Amazon hurt them. By last year, last Christmas season, November, December, I say Christmas, all the holidays, that is the holiday season, from Thanksgiving to January 1st, New Year's, that's where a retail company like Toys R Us is supposed to go from the red to the black, hence the name Black Thursday, or Black Friday, following Thanksgiving Thursday. And what you have is a kind of a last hope at that organization to have a really good holiday season. Instead, Walmart and Target both outsold Toys R Us in toys last holiday season. So they weren't even close to being the top toy retailer. Certainly their online presence, I'm totally unaware of. I'm sure they had one, but I certainly didn't know much about it. Not that I'm in the market for toys normally anyway, other than the holiday season, but I never went there to buy stuff. That's the first interesting thing about this is that it's probably a debt story. The other thing to take away from Toys R Us, and this is going to be maybe going a bit too far, but that model that was used on Toys R Us, private equity buys a public company, takes them private, saddles them with debt, strips out equity, gets paid, moves on, has gone on at a lot of retail organizations. In fact, one of the stories that we haven't talked about much on this show, but that have been covered over the course of the last 2 years in financial media is the weakness in retail stocks. And I would suggest to you that one of those weaknesses or one of the fundamental reasons for the weakness in those stocks is the debt load that these companies, these retail companies, have taken on. And sometimes it had nothing to do with that model, that private equity goes in, saddles the company with debt to pay for the equity that that company then strips out. That's not necessarily the path that debt-laden retail companies took, but the fact remains they were left with a lot of debt. And that, I think, is the biggest reason why retail has been struggling, because retail in general is also Amazon. And we can't forget, too, that when we can't confuse brick and mortar with retail. Retail includes brick and mortar, and it includes online. So a lot of these companies that are struggling have online presences. A lot of them have partnerships with other retailers online that maybe have a stronger online attraction, bigger space on the internet. So it's not Amazonification necessarily. It is if your online presence is worse than your brick and mortar presence. Brick and mortar is not going away. It is just going to contract. And in fact, from an investment perspective, I like brick and mortar for things that have to remain brick and mortar, like restaurants. I mean, movie theaters to a lesser degree, because clearly you can get that content somewhere else online. But, you know, it's not the same thing. I mean, if you've got kids or a spouse and you say, hey, do you want to go to the movies and see this new movie, or do you want to do Netflix? I mean, a lot of times the answer is Netflix because no one wants to go out. But do they not still consider going to the movie theater a treat? Of course they do, because it is different. It's a different experience. So if there is brick and mortar that delivers experience, it's probably going to stick around. If, however, it's not delivering anything different in terms of delivery of good or service than you can get online, well, you're probably going to see it contract at least a little. I made this point on the morning show on Friday with Bruce, and that is that I myself, I'm not going to go use Amazon.com if I find myself in need of something like an HDMI cord, or some kind of audiovisual equipment or a flash drive or whatever, because my need is such that I would like to get it taken care of right now. I don't want to wait 2 days. And by the way, 2 days is not a lot of time to wait. It's fantastic. Love Amazon.
Yeah, and to back up your point, I'm a DJ. So right. There are times right before gigs that I'm like, oh, crap, I need this cord to go with my equipment. I can't wait 2 days, like you said, for a cord to come from Amazon. I need it right now. So, yes, I think Best Buy and Guitar Centers and places like that, they'll stick around.
Yeah, for that reason. Now, they might not grow as prolifically as maybe they would have, 15, 20 years ago, but people still need to go get stuff at stores. Grocery store is another example. I don't doubt that at some point technology is going to lead to a lot of grocery shopping online. That's going to happen. But I also think the grocery stores aren't going away. They might contract too, but they're not going away because some people are going to want to go see the goods before they buy them. It's, in a lot of ways, it's easier. If you're a label reader, it's a hassle to look at all the labels for chili beans online. Why not just go to the store and do it? Get it, come home, you got it. So that's Toys R Us is instructive in a lot of ways, and that's why I found it such an interesting story. We need to take a break right now. When we get back, we'll talk about, I won't tell you what we're going to talk about. It'll be a surprise. But I will tell you can go to freemarketunderground.com, check out the archive shows and the charts I have posted. You might want to do that. We'll take a break. Be right back. Thanks. You're listening to Free Market Underground. Welcome back. The St. Patrick's Day version of Free Market Underground, where every week we engage you in thoughtful discourse about our economy and our markets. My name is Chris Butler, portfolio manager with Butler Lands and Wagler. I'm going to talk now about what I did not tease you with in the last segment, and I did that on purpose. And the reason is it's about trade. And it's such a divisive topic. I hate talking about it because of that. But it is still in the news, and we do need to talk about it. Maybe I can add a little something extra to that conversation. Clearly, I'm in favor of free trade, but I also recognize what happens when you have free trade to certain industries. So I totally see the other side of the argument. Don't get me wrong. And so I wouldn't want to in any way denigrate that argument. It's a good argument and one well worth having in our national dialogue, if you will. But I'm going to proffer today a solution, a non-tariff solution to protecting the steel industry. But in so doing, you would be protecting a lot of industries against cheaper foreign competition. And we're going to start here. Why can our steel that we produce here in the United States, why can it not compete globally? Well, we're told we can't produce steel as cheaply as China. And I suspect that's true. And I would also suspect that's true because China can subsidize that entire industry if they so choose, and they do choose. And then they can dump their cheap steel on foreign markets and kind of dominate the market for steel. And so it drives out of business U.S., European, Canadian, Mexican, Latin American steel companies. And that is the problem. But I want to take the questioning one step further. There are actually many reasons that we can't compete with China's subsidizing of their steel industry. Many. But I'm going to talk about just one today. Because in a sense, China is directly subsidizing their steel production and we are directly hamstringing ours. And I'm talking about regulation, the cost of regulation. In a 2014 report, the National Association of Manufacturers came up with a cost of regulation in the United States, and it's about $2 trillion. Okay? $2 trillion in regulatory cost divided by the 133 million private sector employees in the United States comes to a $15,000 per employee cost for regulation per year. If you want me to repeat that, I'd be happy to. It costs in the United States $15,000 per employee per year in regulation. Now, you might be thinking, well, why did you only divide that number by the number of employees in the private sector? Why not add the public sector employees, which would I think would have taken it to 156 million people? I used 133. Well, that's because, for the most part, the private sector is who pays for the regulation. And that's simple to explain why that is. Because if the federal government had to raise taxes every time it imposed a new regulation, we would have no regulation. There would be a tax riot. Can you imagine? $15,000 per head. Okay, that's a lot of taxes. And the American people would not stand for it. But they're either unaware of it or they don't care, because it gets pushed onto the private sector largely. So there's a $15,000 per employee cost of regulation in this country. Now, the real question is, how much more competitive would U.S. Steel be? And that's a company, U.S. Steel, not the United States steel industry, the company U.S. Steel, if they were not protected by tariffs, but were relieved of their $15,000 per head average regulatory imposition. Well, that company, U.S. Steel, employs about 29,000 people. Their share of the regulatory burden then is 29,000 times $15,000 per head, $435 million per year. Reducing the cost at U.S. Steel by $435 million per year goes a whole lot further than the 500 people the company plans to hire as a result of the tariff plan. And that's an opportunity cost to them of $866,000 for each new position added. Eek. U.S. Steel could hypothetically use the $433 million that it would gain from being relieved of the regulatory burden to expand employment by 4,300 people and pay them $100,000 in salary and benefits a year, or they could cut prices on the steel they produce by $28 per ton and still maintain the same level of profit, net income, that they got in the year 2017. So since it's objectively better to cut the regulatory burden to improve American competitiveness and even more employment, why on earth have we not thought about this before? If you relax the regulatory burden, you're protecting not only the steel industry, but every industry in the United States. You're not playing favorites. You're not saying, I'm only going to protect these folks. You're protecting everyone. By the way, you know, I'm not saying strip away all regulation, all $15,000 per head, but I just want you to see what would happen if you did. Certainly, there's a lot of that can be stripped away, even if you don't share my belief that probably most of it is superfluous. So there's another way to go here, but we haven't had the conversation about why our steel industry is not competitive versus a subsidized Chinese industry. Because all we say is, and I'm guilty of it too, Well, China can subsidize their steel industry. Okay, so why can't we compete with that? That's the next question that has to be asked. And if you ask that question, you have a conversation, and you have a conversation about the impediments to making steel cheaper here in the United States. My guess is that a lot of folks who have some pretty loud opinions about tariffs and protecting the steel industry today would have much more muted views if we had that conversation. But more importantly, I don't care if their views are muted or loud. I care that we're actually getting to the heart of the problem, and at least part of the problem. Like I said at the very beginning, there are a lot of reasons why the United States can't produce steel as cheaply as China. And by the way, we're probably better off than the European Union, than Canada, maybe not Mexico. But, I mean, we do not – those countries I just mentioned, Canada, European Union, which is primarily in terms of steel manufacturing, Germany, they saddle those folks with a whole lot of regulatory burden too, probably more than we do. So if we want a competitive advantage, why don't we relax our comparatively less regulatory burden even more and really compete on the global stage? And I would be remiss if I didn't add, we've done a lot of regulatory cutting anyway. We have, and we've made some great progress here. However, this would work probably more evenly, what I would consider to be more fairly, and lead to greater competitiveness in a global, highly competitive global arena, particularly as it relates to steel. So, you know, just some food for thought there. One way to make us more competitive without having to impose a tariff, which, by the way, as I talked about several weeks ago, when you do a tariff, you're actually helping out producers of whatever good you're trying to protect, but you're doing it at the expense of the consumer of that good. So it's just a less efficient way to, say, punish China. By punishing China with a tariff, you're also punishing U.S. consumers. It's not a very efficient way to punish anybody. So this is a way that you can do it where it's, like I said, a lot more fair. Wanted to touch briefly before we take a break here on some of what's going on with our economy, particularly if you follow the Atlanta Fed's GDP Now. They have a real-time update to their estimates for gross domestic product for the American economy every time a significant economic report is released. Earlier this year, they were predicting or estimating 5.5% annualized growth in the first quarter. It is now down below 2. It's like 1.9. It's not very good, obviously. And if you read my company's newsletter, which you probably just, if you do, you probably just got it this week or late last week. And I talked about this on the radio show last week. The growth of the U.S. economy is decelerating. It is still positive. We are still growing. We're just not growing as fast as we did in the latter quarter, let's say, of 2017. We're decelerating. And there are a lot of reasons why that's the case, but and it's got nothing to do with anything that Trump has done. In fact, the tax cuts have probably already kept it from decelerating further. And in the end, we might see the tax cuts really kick in at the midpoint of this year, 2018, latter part of this year, early part of 2019, and we might see reacceleration. But right now, we're seeing deceleration. And that was evident in a lot of stuff that was released this week. Not all of it. Some of it showed some pretty good strength. We'll get into that in the next segment. But I did just want to do a quick survey, which we will do in the next segment, of what all is going on that looks to be weak or weakening And we'll touch on those things that looked pretty good, too. But we do need to take a break. You're listening to Free Market Underground on KCMO Talk Radio 710, now heard on 103.7 FM as well. Ah, the music of my people, Martell.
Yes. The Irish.
The Irish. And I couldn't, these are my people. I couldn't do an Irish accent to save my life.
Are you really Irish?
I am.
Wow.
Very heavily.
Not a smudge of Irish accent in you? Come
no.
on, Chris Butler.
No, I can't. I wish I could. I wish I had the delivery of the leprechaun on the Lucky Charms commercials.
Yes.
That guy was tight.
Oh, yeah, he was.
I like that guy.
I'm so disappointed in you, Chris Butler.
Yeah.
I'm an Irishman right here with me.
That's right.
You can't even give me a Lucky Charms.
No, I can't, but I can give you, hello, Gebne. You know, I do the British thing. Cannot.
No Irish.
No Irish.
Well, are you gonna knock back to Jameson this weekend?
I probably will involve myself in a lot of Irish traditions, including
yes.
corned beef and cabbage, which I know a lot of people with good taste don't like. And I don't blame them because it's an acquired taste.
Yes.
But we've always had it for St. Patrick's Day since I can remember.
I'm a fan of the corned beef.
I am too. No. I really do like corned beef. The cabbage took me till I was an adult to appreciate. I didn't like it. But now if I pepper it up enough, it's kind of like...
It's good stuff.
Yeah, it's okay.
My mom makes the best cabbage.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
And I think that is the crux of it. If you can make it well,
yes,
it's probably pretty good. I know that I do not. I don't make it well. My wife does. My mom used to. It takes somebody who knows what they're doing with cabbage.
You got me hungry now.
Yeah, that's right. Corned beef and cabbage.
So do you know the origin of St. Patty's Day?
I do not.
Okay.
I do not.
Disappointed again.
That's yeah, right.
Two strikes, Chris Butler.
Right. I do know the myth of St. Patrick driving the snakes out of Ireland. But beyond that, I don't know. I know that it has also something to do with, in the United States anyway, the recognition of it has to do with the large Irish immigrant population. Probably starting before the potato famine, but that immigration from Ireland really took a serious grade upward in the middle part of the 1800s with the potato famine, which is what sent my great-grandfather to the United States, or at least one of them, as a small child suffering from malnourishment from that potato famine because his family just didn't have any money to buy food. So they came over here. He became a teacher in mid-Missouri. I do know that. You know, what's interesting, Ancestry DNA, I would have guessed that my lineage was 70% Irish, and I have not done the Ancestry DNA thing, but my sister did. And I was very surprised at the findings. I'm more than Irish, man. I'm more than French, more than German. I mean, I have a little bit of everything inside me, including American Native American Indian. So when I say my people now, Martell, you know I'm not narrowing the field at all. Everyone is my people.
I'm your people.
You are my people.
Yes.
And that is... The great thing about Ancestry, and I need to do it myself because I don't understand genetics, but my sister tells me mine might be a little different than hers. I don't know why that would be, but she seems to think that if I did it, we'd get some kind of additional information, which I will do, actually. But for the most part, I am British Isles, kind of a lot of my heritage is British Isles. All right, what I wanted to talk about here is just a kind of a round robin on what went on economically this week. Retail sales were bad. PPI was producer price index was high. That's an inflation indicator. But CPI was a little less than expected. Still, I would call it firm, but I would not say that it is high or getting higher. Import prices, also an inflation indicator. Came in hot at a 0.4% increase this month. We had a 1% gain the month before. Import prices are heating up. And so I think it's safe to say at this point, China is exporting their inflation. After decades of exporting their deflation, they are now exporting, at least temporarily, inflation. And that will be hurting our price levels here in the United States. That will also hurt probably some profits. Housing starts were bad. Housing permits were bad. The Empire State Manufacturing Index, the Philly Fed Manufacturing Index, both of those were fine. In fact, I believe it was the Philly Fed that was actually, I'd go so far as to say, very strong. Small business optimism was also very strong. Confidence among small business owners approached record-setting levels for the month of February, stuff with the information we got this week. Let's see here. We are now 0.7 point from a 45-year high that was set in 1983. Can you believe that? We talked about the Atlanta Fed and its GDP Now number, but the last thing I wanted to get to on that was business inventories. Business inventories haven't been looking real good over the past couple of months. They're rising, which means people aren't buying them. Sales are down. Inventories are high. That's another sign of kind of a weakening or decelerating economy. So that ought to be going into some of your more shorter term and intermediate term investment decisions. We talked about this at length last week. We talked about it at length in our newsletter. The economy is simply decelerating. Is that anything to worry about? Not really, not now, because the deceleration, we've already seen three bouts of deceleration since the last recession. This would be four. So in that sense, no, I wouldn't worry too much about it. On the other hand, all true recessions start first with this decelerating pattern. So we have to be aware that we might not pull out of it and might go straight into recession. That is a possibility. Right now, though, the leading indicators, which started decelerating before the economy did, as you might expect, the actual index, not the growth rate, but if you just look at the index itself, it doesn't look that bad. And so I probably would not be willing to think that at this point we've got a recession in the offing. But you look at things like the yield curve, which is flattening. It's in the danger zone. I wouldn't say it's predicting a recession. It's not. But it is so low that, yeah, it bears some attention too. So I've been looking at a lot of those economic indicators that come out and saying, okay, are we seeing economic deceleration here with this? Or are we seeing strength with this? Well, this week, we kind of got a little bit of both. We did see some deceleration in a lot of things. We saw some strength in a lot of things. Which should trump the other? I'm not real sure. I think the fact that the manufacturing surveys from the Philly Fed and the Empire State Manufacturing Survey, those numbers, I think, are very important. And it seems like manufacturing is not seeing the same kind of decelerating that we're seeing elsewhere. So that also gives us room for some confidence. Looks like we're out of time for today. Stay tuned for Don Wills, Protecting Your Retirement. That comes up next. This show is sponsored by Butler Lands and Wagler. I want to thank you for listening to Free Market Underground, all things boom and bust. Thank you, Martell Love, for producing and for the Irish music interludes.
No problem.
Until next Saturday, have a great week and a great St. Patrick's Day.